This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 6th, 2009, from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns, in for Ara Bogado. In today's program, we visit doctors in Egypt waiting at the Gaza border crossing to deliver medical help and supplies to residents of the region. The U.S. Senate prepares to vet President-elect Barack Obama's appointments to the Justice Department. And the Bush administration announces plans to create 3 vast marine reserves in the Pacific, meaning Bush will ultimately protect more ocean than any other president in history. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United States Senate and the House of Representatives officially opened the 111th Congress today with the swearing-in ceremony conducted by the President of the Senate, Dick Cheney.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which you're about to enter. So help you God.
I do.
Congratulations.
However, some Senate seats are still unsettled. Roland Burris, appointed by Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich to replace President-elect Barack Obama, arrived on Capitol Hill for the first day, but was not allowed to enter the Senate chamber.
I will now consult with my attorneys, and we will determine what our next step will be. Thank you all very much, and God bless each and every one of you. Thank you.
His next step could be the courts or working out a deal with Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid. Reid has said he will not seat Burris because the appointment was made by the tainted governor of Illinois. The Minnesota senator was also not sworn in today as battles continue between incumbent Republican Norm Coleman and Democrat Al Franken. And in the House of Representatives, members re-elected California Democrat Nancy Pelosi as Speaker of the House. She defeated Republican John Boehner. Alarm is growing in Europe as a dispute over prices worsens between Russian gas company Gazprom and neighboring Ukraine, whose pipeline delivers a large proportion of Europe's gas. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
In the early hours of this morning, Russian supplies of gas to the EU fell by 70%. European countries depend on Russian gas for about a quarter of their total needs, 80% of which is pumped through a Ukrainian pipeline. Some EU members are entirely dependent on Russian gas and only hold a few days' supply in storage. Slovakia has declared a state of emergency. So why has Russia cut supplies? Russian gas company Gazprom says the Ukraine hasn't paid in full for the gas delivered in 2008, and it owes $600 million. Julian Lee of the Center for Global Energy Studies.
Gazprom says it is continuing to put gas through the pipelines that cross Ukraine for delivery to consumers in Europe. However, it accuses Ukraine of having taken some of that gas out of the pipeline for its own use. Russia has therefore cut the pressure to correspond to the amount that it says Ukraine has taken out of the pipeline.
The Ukrainian government denies theft, and its gas company website advises European users receiving reduced volumes of natural gas to direct their complaints to Gazprom. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Overloaded automated unemployment claims systems have crashed in 2 states. Both North Carolina and New York report today that online and telephone systems have experienced problems. In New York, more than 10,000 jobless people per hour are trying to access the system ahead of a looming filing deadline next weekend. There's no word yet as to when New York's system will be repaired. And in North Carolina, the internet claims site crashed twice, accompanied by phone line problems yesterday. Once the system was restored, they processed a one-day record number of requests, 106,000 transactions totaling $31.5 million in unemployment benefits. 5 former security guards for Blackwater Worldwide, accused of manslaughter in the 2007 deaths of 17 Iraqi civilians, were arraigned and pleaded not guilty today. Prosecutors claim the men were unprovoked. Defense counsel says they opened fire after coming under attack. The director of the Iraqi Human Rights Ministry, Kamil Amind, says the trial should have been held in Iraq, calling it a sovereignty issue. Defense attorneys are expected to argue that the men have been charged under a law that only applies to soldiers and military contractors, not civilian contractors who work for the State Department. And at a hearing today regarding the detention of a Yemeni man at Guantanamo Bay, a district judge accused the Bush administration of what he called another example of hiding evidence from the courts. U.S. District Judge Emmett G. Sullivan said that Justice Department lawyers have intentionally delayed turning over government documents from the Defense Department since September. Judge Sullivan said he is therefore unable to rule on whether or not to free Ayman Saeed Batarfi until he reviews the classified material. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
The death toll in Gaza continues to rise as Israel maintains its ground attack against the region. Today, Israeli bombs hit a UN school that was being used as a shelter and killed more than 40 people. The UN claims the school was clearly marked. And in Gaza City, an Israeli airstrike destroyed a family home and killed at least 12 members of the Daya family who were inside. And now Jews in Europe are feeling a backlash from the volatile situation in the Middle East. News of anti-Semitic attacks is beginning to surface in Sweden, Denmark, France, and Great Britain. In other news, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak met Monday with French President Nicolas Sarkozy and a European Union delegation to discuss ways to reach an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And reports from these talks are somewhat promising. Israel has indicated it would consider a ceasefire if international security forces agree to intervene. Still, a final agreement could be days or weeks off. On the ground, the town of Rafah, which stands at the border between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, has been turned into a grassroots site of action. There, doctors are waiting to get through to the injured with ambulances and medical supplies. Aya Batrawi has more from Rafah.
World leaders met Monday at the Red Sea resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh. We're just a few hours' drive away on the same Sinai Peninsula. The sound of calm waves crashing against the shore were replaced by bombs exploding overhead in Rafah. Standing at the edge of Rafah, which is the only official crossing point between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, one can catch a glimpse of the war raging on in Gaza. Unmanned Israeli spy drones can be heard hovering overhead 24 hours a day. After nearly a year of blockade that saw little goods being allowed into Gaza, the last 11 days of attacks have left some 560 Palestinians dead and another 2,600 injured. With little options left and sympathy for Palestinians running high, many here in Egypt and across the Arab world have responded through charity. Mas'oud spent all night and day traveling from his home in Alexandria to transport some 10 tons of medical supplies in two trucks. Mas'oud and his team of volunteers had to pass through no less than 11 checkpoints due to increased security in the Sinai. Once at Rafah, Mas'oud and his team also faced Israeli F-16s opening fire just kilometers away. But the dangers were worth it. He said the moment the supplies reached the border was the happiest moment of his life.
The idea is that now all of Gaza is suffering injuries. They are all injured in some way. I doubt anyone in Gaza can do more than what we are trying to do. What was the reason behind why we left our work and homes? We have been 24 hours traveling without sleep or eating to deliver these goods. And we did this because of our humanity.
There are dozens more volunteers at the border with Gaza, not waiting to see if meetings in Sharm el-Sheikh or at the UN Security Council in New York can solve the crisis. Jordanian neurosurgeon Dr. Mohamed Khawaldi is one of at least 20 international doctors who have come to the border to help.
We are not here to raise swords or fight. We are here to heal. I will be here, God willing, until the war ends or we enter. There is no return home until the war ends and everything is okay. But as long as injured people are coming out, I am not returning.
While 20 injured Palestinians crossed over into Gaza Monday for treatment, Israel, which controls all of Gaza's borders, has not allowed doctors to enter. But some medical supplies have been able to reach Gaza from as far away as Turkey, Indonesia, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia through the Rafah border. But there is no guarantee, once in Gaza, the supplies will be able to reach the needy. Israel has blocked all major roads and shot at vehicles, including ambulances and supply trucks. This has not stopped Kamed Bashir, a Palestinian truck driver in Rafah, who said he is not afraid of being fired at and will continue transporting supplies into Gaza.
When God has it written in your destiny to die, you die. I am not scared.
And while there is no guarantee the border will be open to doctors to get through or that the medical supplies will reach the most needed places, for now, the tense Rafah border crossing is an uncertain refuge for people waiting patiently for peace. From Rafah, the Egyptian border with Gaza Strip, this is Aya Batraoui for Free Speech Radio News.
Gaza City is currently a city under siege. Gun battles and Israeli airstrikes have ravaged the city for days now. Free Speech Radio News has been following the situation closely, and much of our coverage comes from our reporter Rami Almagari, who actually lives in Gaza with his family. He's brought us news of ground battles, civilian deaths, displaced people, and the humanitarian crisis in the area. But today, he brings us a personal account of what it's like to live in a war zone. In this reporter's notebook, Rami explores split loyalties between his pull to get the story as a journalist and his constant fear for his family and children.
December 27 started as a calm, sunny day, but around 11:30 a.m., as I was trying to fix my car's radio, suddenly loud bombings occurred overhead. Pillars of smoke began rising up in the sky. The main thing I cared about at that moment was my four children, particularly my two-year-old son, Mohammed, who always follows me when I am off work on weekends. I picked up my cell phone and began calling contacts to figure out what was going on. Then I made sure my kids were okay inside the home and I drove towards the Gaza City. It was complete destruction. In a course of a few seconds, scores of targets, including municipal buildings, police stations, and the charities were completely leveled to the ground. A mix of feelings has ripped through me since then. Being a reporter, a father, and a local Palestinian refugee, the first thing I thought of was to stockpile some food for my children, then to ensure some benzene for my car and my power generator. The more Israeli attacks on the region spread from an area to another, the more I am worried about my children. Mohammed, my son, heard the bombings, for the first time ever cried, "Baba, hey," the only word he uttered when he heard the first bombings. Amid such conditions, for the past few days, 10 relatives of mine, 6 of them children, have come to stay at my house. Their home in the nearby Nusayrat refugee camp is next to some people who Israel considers Hamas terrorists. Thanks goes to my wife, who is always understanding of my work pressure. She and my cute children, Asil, Nadine, Munir, and even Mohammed, have ensured me a quiet atmosphere to work in. As attacks continue, I am reporting under enormous pressure, dealing with the prolonged power outages, lack of benzene to run my car and my small power generator, and the broken recording equipment. But with the help of my friend, colleague, and FSRN reporter Ghassan Barnoura in the West Bank, I have been able to continue filing reports. Thank you, Ghassan. The most important thing that I need is to keep up whatever pressure I am facing. I am a local Palestinian who lives the situation minute by minute. Israel has denied access into Gaza for international reporters, so I need to do what I can to get information out of Gaza. Many of my relatives, and thousands more here in Gaza, have fled to UNRWA-run schools because of continuous Israeli shelling of populated neighborhoods. But as I am writing this script, reports say Israeli shells killed dozens of civilians who were taking shelter at an UNRWA-run school in the northern Jabalia refugee camp. There are a few places, if any, where we can truly be safe. Today I can file, I can have my voice and voices of others heard in the US, but who knows if these voices will be heard tomorrow. For Rafa Saran's Reporter's Notebook, I am Rami Al-Mighari in Gaza.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News online at fsrn.org. The 111th Congress convened today. This could be a historic session for the progressive movement, with Democrats having a double majority in the legislature and Barack Obama soon to be taking office. But anti-war activists were at the Capitol today to give Congress a grim welcome. In Washington, D.C., Sam Greenspan has the story.
Clad in black robes and white death masks, about 50 activists marched around the House and Senate buildings today. The so-called March of the Dead seeks to remind the new Congress that many Americans want a commitment to a troop withdrawal timetable.
People around the country and around the world are fed up at this point.
That's David Swanson. Swanson founded the website AfterDowningStreet.com and also partnered with the Green Party and the peace group Code Pink to organize today's event.
So this is the second time we clearly elected a Congress to end these wars, and there's not an indication that they're going to quickly do so. So we're here on day one, in fact, hour one, as they're being sworn in, to say we are going to make this demand present on Capitol Hill for the coming days, weeks, months, until we end these things. You know, we are hearing at the moment about Gaza, but if this goes on in Gaza for months and years, it will fade away, and it shouldn't. And so the presence of U.S. citizens here on Capitol Hill shouldn't go away either. And so we are bringing the dead to the congressmen.
Marchers wore the names of individuals killed in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Gaza in the ongoing conflicts. Swanson, too, held a cardboard sign.
Assuming I'm pronouncing the name right, it says Khadija, age 13, killed December 12, 2006 in Afghanistan. And that's all I know about that person, except that they should be alive.
Across the street from the demonstrators and inside the Capitol building, Congressman Raul Grijalva from Arizona is being sworn in. As the newly appointed co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, Grijalva says that he is committed to ensuring that the Obama administration will maintain their troop withdrawal timetable and also work to prevent the war in Afghanistan from becoming a quagmire.
Focusing on, I think, the issue of the war in Iraq and making sure that we hold Congress accountable and the administration, quite frankly, to the timetable. We need to extract ourselves from there, and we can't contradict the commitments that were made to the American voters. I think that's vital. How, when, and the intensity of what we do in Afghanistan is a concern to many members of the caucus. Are we embarking on a similar foreign excursion as we did in Iraq, where there was no end in sight and where we haven't fully used the international community to help us deal with that issue? Time to use friendship and cooperation, and we're going to push for that.
Obama's campaign pledge was to withdraw troops in 16 months from taking office, though he has since said that he will hear military advice for an appropriate timetable for withdrawal. Sam Greenspan, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
President George Bush will not likely be remembered as a champion of environmental causes. On the contrary, he has done more than any president in recent history to weaken clean air and water laws in favor of big business. But today, environmentalists are giving him a feather for his cap. The administration has announced the creation of three new marine national monuments around remote islands in the central and western Pacific Ocean. Lisa Speer is the director of the National Resource Defense Council's International Oceans Program. She says it's important to protect pristine areas as reference points to measure degradation in other ocean regions.
It becomes much more difficult to protect large areas once you have invested industrial operations already in place. Once you have fishing, mining, oil and gas development, polluting activities, it becomes much more difficult to actually establish a protected area. It's not impossible, but it is much more difficult. So I think it's very important to protect pristine areas to the extent that we can so that the world can continue to have some areas that remain untouched. As we move forward, we're going to be confronting more difficult, politically difficult situations in establishing protected areas. But this gets us off to a good start.
The reserves will massively restrict oil and gas exploration and commercial fishing. They will cover nearly 200,000 square miles, an area roughly the size of Spain. President-elect Barack Obama is expecting to name Leon Panetta to head the CIA. The former member of Congress, Clinton Chief of Staff and Office of Management and Budget Director, is receiving a mixed reception. Some say he lacks the intelligence background necessary to run the CIA. Others say his strong management skills can put the crippled agency back in order. Meanwhile, the Senate Judiciary Committee is preparing to hold confirmation hearings for Eric Holder, Barack Obama's nominee to head the Justice Department. President-elect Obama has also announced more appointments to that agency. Don Johnson was nominated to head the Office of Legal Counsel. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, the Office of Legal Counsel has become one of the most critical posts in the entire Justice Department.
The Office of Legal Counsel, which gives legal advice to the president, has been an important but often inconspicuous position at the Department of Justice until the Bush administration, when the office became embroiled in fierce criticism and congressional subpoenas. Under the Bush administration, the Office of Legal Counsel provided the president with the infamous torture memo, which justified the use of harsh interrogation tactics prohibited by international law. The Office of Legal Counsel also defended the unitary executive during wartime, a broad expansion of the president's power, which justified surveillance of U.S. citizens. Critics of President Bush's Office of Legal Counsel are praising Don Johnson, Obama's choice to lead the office. She's currently a law professor at the University of Indiana, Bloomington. Catherine Colbert, president of People for the American Way, says Johnson is the right person to rein in presidential power.
She's smart. She's able. She cares about the Constitution and enforcing constitutional values in a very particular way. And she will work very hard to undo the damage that has been brought about by 8 years of the Bush administration.
One of Johnson's latest published pieces is titled Faithfully Executing the Laws, Internal Legal Constraints on Executive Power. She criticizes the Bush administration and his legal advisors for what she calls an extreme view of expansive powers. In another article on Slate.com last year, Johnson wrote that the new president must investigate and make public illegal conduct and wrongdoing by the Bush administration. Some conservative groups, though, are opposed to Johnson's nomination because of her work on behalf of abortion rights. As the confirmation hearings for Eric Holder to be Attorney General approaches, civil rights groups are ramping up support. As possibly the first African-American Attorney General, they say he's the right person to restore civil rights at the Justice Department, a department that under the Bush administration has been accused of politicization and ignoring important civil rights issues such as voter disenfranchisement. Gary Hebert is president of the Campaign Legal Center and was a career employee at the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department until he became disillusioned with changes made in recent years. But Hebert says Holder is a good pick to turn the division around.
He's known for having a lot of integrity and honesty in decision-making, takes responsibility for things, and is very effective in carrying them out. So I was delighted to hear of his selection.
But conservatives are mounting their opposition to Eric Holder. They cite his actions as acting attorney general during the Clinton administration, where he pardoned convicted felon Mark Rich, whose wife was a Clinton donor, who was jailed for fleeing the country and tax evasion. Chris Farrell is director of research at Judicial Watch.
There are probably four, maybe five different areas or topics where Mr. Holder has an established set of decisions and actions that can be questioned and scrutinized, and I'm sure that he has an explanation for all of them, but I think it's important that everybody hears what he did and how he arrived at those decisions and actions.
Despite some critics, it is expected that Obama's justice nominees will pass through the Senate confirmation process. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
15 years have passed since the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994 and the coinciding uprising of Mexico's indigenous rebel guerrilla organization in the state of Chiapas. The Zapatista National Liberation Army celebrated their anniversary by organizing the first global festival of Dignified Rage. The festival was held in rebel territory in the city of Ovintic at the University of the Earth in San Cristobal de las Casas. Luz Ruiz and Tim Russo bring us more from Chiapas.
Thousands gathered in the first global festival of Dignified Rage, which was organized around four major themes: exploitation, dispossession, repression, and devaluation. Indigenous peoples from around the world and Mexico had a major voice in the festival. Purépecha Juan Chávez is with the Mexican National Indigenous Congress.
It has been possible to survive for more than 516 years without having to necessarily depend on money. With respect, we extract from our Mother Earth the resources we need. I believe that it is possible to live without having a great amount of concentration like the big banks, who are only achieving the destruction of the planet and life.
Fuera ejército de Israel del territorio palestino. Justicia y libertad para el pueblo palestino.
A recurring theme during the Global Festival of Dignified Rage was the universal condemnation of the Israeli attacks on Gaza. Spokesperson for the Zapatista National Liberation Army, Subcomandante Marcos.
We do not have the honor of having been in Palestine, but we suppose that in the bombarded homes and buildings, there lived people, men, women, children, elders, and not soldiers. Maybe our analysis is very simple, and other elements are needed for our analysis. But for us, the Zapatistas, in Gaza there is a professional army murdering a defenseless population. Who from below and to the left can keep quiet?
Women and indigenous women in particular were among the many that participated in the event. America Painemal, Mapuche women of the Rural and Indigenous Women Association and member of Via Campesina, spoke about why she had traveled to Chiapas with the Zapatistas.
Our struggles are not only about indigenous peoples, farmers, the landless, urban people also need to know about different possibilities, to know that a just society can be constructed. And we are here because we need to join forces, become allies. It is not an easy process, and maybe it will not happen in our lifetime, but we need to plant the seeds for something new to emerge.
The Zapatistas, in their final statements, reiterated the importance to cherish and embrace the diversity of movements and people from around the globe. Commander David, one of the 23 members of the EZLN's Clandestine Revolutionary Indigenous Committee, closed with these final words on Monday night.
Pero lo más importante es que hay luchas.
The dignified rage of different social sectors throughout the world will keep growing and strengthening even amongst the differences between each sector. But in this struggle, we have to walk together. Our struggle for humanity will continue, that our resistance, our rebelliousness, our dignified rage grow each day and become stronger.
At the end of the night, the nearly 2,000 participants began their journey back home with one request from the Zapatistas, to organize locally from the roots up, or in the EZLN's words, below and to the left, where our heart is placed. From San Cristóbal de las Casas, Mexico, this is Luz Ruiz with Tim Russo.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Headlines editor, Nell Abram. DC editor, Leanne Caldwell. And the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Elena Botkin-Levy and Puck Lowe. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.